Good morning, I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence. As Brazil copes with the aftermath of a deadly nightclub fire, authorities there are looking to Rhode Island for help. The state's former Attorney General, Patrick Lynch, is in southern Brazil working with prosecutors and other officials. According to WPRI, he left on Monday. His trip comes as Rhode Island prepares to mark the 10th anniversary of the station nightclub fire tomorrow. Just like the fire in Brazil, that blaze was sparked by fireworks that were part of a stage display. When he was Attorney General, Patrick Lynch brought charges against three people in the West Warwick fire. So far, Kurt Schilling's Bloody Sock has a highest bid of $32,500 in an online auction of this piece of baseball history. As Rhode Island Public Radio's Catherine Welch reports, the sock is expected to go for more than $100,000.
While on the mound during the 2004 World Series, former Red Sox pitcher Kurt Schilling's ankles started to bleed. His blood-stained sock became an instant icon and the symbol of his career. Well, a failed video game business and millions of dollars in debt later, a broke Schilling pulled the sock from the National Baseball Hall of Fame and put it up for auction. Bidding started last month, and auctioneer Chris Ivey says who knows what will happen with this one-of-a-kind piece.
This piece has been exhibited in the Baseball Hall of Fame for years. It's the embodiment of what I call the blood, sweat, and tears that it took the Boston Red Sox to overcome the curse of the Bambino.
Ivey says bidding will wrap up on Saturday with a live auction. Catherine Welch, Rhode Island Public Radio.
In Rhode Island, medical marijuana is already legal, with people called caregivers selling it to patients, and the state has also established three distribution or compassion centers that haven't opened yet. In Massachusetts, regulators are still considering how to implement that state's medical marijuana law. And as Rhode Island Public Radio's healthcare reporter Kristen Gourlay finds, doctors there want tighter controls.
Massachusetts Department of Public Health is accepting public comments now on how it should regulate the state's new medical marijuana law. The Massachusetts Medical Society opposed the law originally, but now that it's on the books, the society wants to make sure doctors follow strong guidelines when prescribing a drug it says is not yet well understood. Spokesman and family doctor James Broadhurst says doctors who opt to certify patients to use medical marijuana should not only have an established relationship with those patients.
That there is consultation with an expert if necessary and that you have proper record keeping, and that among the other things is that the individual have adequate training in identifying substance abuse and addiction.
Rhode Island's Board of Medical Licensure and Discipline issued its own recommendations, but they don't include substance abuse and addiction training. Kristen Gourlay, Rhode Island Public Radio.
And privately owned wells are at risk for bacteria pollution due to melting snow. That's the word from the Rhode Island Department of Health. Spokeswoman Dara Chadwick says excessive runoff could make well water dangerous to drink.
Wells can become contaminated with bacteria and pathogens when they become flooded. What happens is that the standing water around the wellhead might become contaminated and trickle down along the casing and therefore contaminate the drinking waters.
Chadwick advises any private well owners that experience flooding to have their water tested, and a flood advisory will remain in effect through the spring.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that completely, Ian. You know, we try to work very closely with our state counterparts, with Attorney General Kilmartin and the prosecutors over there to figure out, you know, where a case should best be charged. Now, there are some instances where, you know, it's the right call to do it in federal court because of the nature of the defendant, the nature of the crime. And sometimes the sentence will be a little bit stiffer in theory in federal court. But there are other times where, you know, someone may be on a long suspended sentence in state court, and that may be a good place to bring the case over there. Now, the longest sentence isn't always justice. In gun cases, many times it is. But there are some instances where choice of forum, it really depends on what the best result is. And we try to work closely on that.
About how many gun-related prosecutions does your office do each year?
Well, it varies, but I would say on average we probably do about 45. In recent years, the last couple of years, we've done more than that. You know, if you go back a little bit farther, we've done less. I'd say on average about 40 to 45, which, you know, compared to the number of cases the state does, is very, very low. You know, we try to focus on those cases as sort of the worst of the worst. But also we have a predicate for us to do a case. Typically, the person has to be a felon already. And so, for example, your person with no criminal history who has a gun illegally, doesn't have a license, would not be a crime that we could even prosecute.
Beyond what you just mentioned, what is some of the other criteria that would determine whether a federal case would be brought in a gun-related crime or a state prosecution?
If you have three prior crimes of violence, that subjects you federally to a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence. So if you have, you know, on your record murders or burglaries or drug trafficking offenses, you know, you've got a long history of violent crime, you're looking at that 15-year mandatory minimum sentence. That's a case we would strongly consider taking because that's someone we would really consider to be the worst of the worst. If you use the gun in connection with a crime of violence, that can lead to 5 years on top of whatever you get for, say, the drug trafficking crime. And we would look at those cases. You know, if you're a gang member or someone with a history of domestic violence, you know, someone who really warrants sort of the severe federal penalties that often attach, you know, we would kind of look closely at those cases. But also, you know, we've reached out to all of the local police departments. If they have someone in their city or town who's a particular problem for them in terms of, you know, there are individuals we know that kind of drive crime. If a city or town police chief would tell us that this guy is one of our worst, one of our top 10, then we might focus our attention on that person.
A quartet of congressmen, a mix of Democrats and Republicans, including a former federal prosecutor, last week unveiled a proposal to make gun trafficking a federal crime. Where does the federal government stand on whether that's a good idea?
Well, I know that the department takes a position that the lack of a true federal trafficking statute does present some challenges. That said, you know, I think that we as U.S. attorneys, and I can only really focus on Rhode Island, you know, I think for the most part, and I'm not saying that legislation should or shouldn't be passed. It's not my call. It's not appropriate for me to comment on that. But what I will say is that for the most part, we have the tools that we need to get the job done. And I think that we are aggressively prosecuting firearms cases, and we've been doing that over the years. There is not a gun case that is presented to us that if we could prove, and we believe it's appropriate, meaning the federal form is the right form, that we would not take.
What are the main obstacles to reducing the illegal gun trade in Rhode Island?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of parts to that question. I really view sort of the gun problem here really as two principal problems. The first is a sort of violent crime that we see on our streets. And what we see there is there's not a lot of trafficking in terms of the proportion of guns that are in Rhode Island. There are guns that come into the state, but a lot of the guns have been here for a very long time, and they're simply circulated around. They're community guns, and they are way too accessible to people who, in the spur of the moment, in the heat of a conflict, can get access to that gun and do harm. In some cases, lethal harm. So that's one part of the problem. The other problem that I think that I see out there occurs less frequently, but can have more impact per incident, and that's the kind of Newtown, Aurora situation where someone with a mental health problem can get access to a gun. And that's a place where I think in Rhode Island, I know that there are a number of state leaders, including the Attorney General, including Commissioner Perry, including Colonel O'Donnell and others, who are working to fix this issue of not getting mental health records into the national database for running checks. Right now, when you go to purchase a firearm, you have to fill out some questions. Amongst them are whether or not you've been institutionalized or have been deemed a danger to yourself or others by a court. That information is not submitted by Rhode Island into that database. So in the 11,000 checks that we ran for guns in 2011, that issue was never checked. And I think we need to make substantial progress there. There are going to be fewer incidents of that nature, but they cause so much damage.
It seems that a lot of violent gun-related crime is concentrated in the poor parts of American cities, as in Providence. And we know that this is related to other complicated social issues, including poverty and the illegal trafficking of drugs. Do you think the current approach of federal prosecutors to trying to get a handle on the gun-related crime that's a part of that is as good as it gets, or are there other things that can be done to do better?
You know, I think we have this great luxury, at least in Rhode Island, of having enough prosecutors, enough law enforcement agents that working with the Providence Police Department and the Attorney General's office and with the state police to really target this gun problem. The issue here, frankly, is you can't just prosecute your way out of these problems. You know, as I see it, you know, you have to engage in prevention. You have to engage on the flip side, which is when people are coming out of prison, trying to ensure that they're not going back out onto the street. And, you know, if we simply try to prosecute our way out of the gun problem, we won't make the kind of progress we need to make. We need to try to reach at least some portion of those potential reoffenders to make sure they're not going back to the life out there in the street. And that would include things like job training and drug and alcohol treatment and mental health treatment to try to prevent some of these people from getting back on that road to crime. There are some agencies here in the city of Providence and elsewhere around the state that do a good job of that. You know, it's one of those things that in difficult economic times tend to be on the chopping block, and we just need to renew and maintain our commitment to them.
U.S. Attorney Peter Nerona, thank you for sitting down with us.
And you're welcome. Glad to be here.